A couple weeks ago, I got invited by a friend to go to a luncheon. David Green is the new morning co-anchor of Morning Edition on NPR with Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne. And he was in Peoria for a fundraiser for WCBU. And so there was a dinner one evening. And then after the dinner, I had lunch with about 30 of us had lunch with him. And it was good. And so we had lunch and just talked. And then after lunch, he just sat there and took questions for probably about 45 minutes. It was great. And they were asking him questions about just like, you know, tell us about when you were in Moscow. He was in Moscow for a while. He almost ended up going to Baghdad as the bureau chief for NPR in Baghdad. His wife wasn't super excited about that. And then, but anyway, he was talking about a time in his career, and I think it was in the late 90s when there was a civil war in Pakistan. And I believe, if I remember the story right, it's not super important, but I believe if I remember the story right, he was on the border of Pakistan and Uzbekistan where he was covering the story. Because what happens when there's a civil war in almost any setting is you get this mass flood of refugees out of the country, people just trying to get out of the way. And there had been such a flood of refugees that had gone to the various countries surrounding it that these countries were now starting to close their borders and not allow any more refugees, which often happens as well. And so he was covering that. And so he was at the border, and what was happening is as the refugees were fleeing the one country, they were being shot at by snipers, but there were guards standing at the gates guarding the refugees from coming into the other. And he said there was two things about that event. Well, one was just the horror of it all. But then he started talking about the humanity, and he said there was a person who had been shot by a sniper, and there was a hole in the fence that the guards were standing in front of guarding. And he said the family members and the loved ones of this person who had been shot picked them up and brought them to the border, and when they got to the border, the guards basically just looked the other way so they could pass this person's body through the fence so that they could get the person the help that they needed. And he said what was incredibly profound in the moment was, one, just the humanity of it. That in the middle of this chaos, in the middle of these guards being told you have a job to keep people out, that they could look the other way and allow somebody to come through the fence because they just needed to get through the fence. And he said that was really beautiful. And then he said something that when he asked this question, I said, ka-ching, Easter sermon. He asked, why does the world have to be like this? He said, standing at the border that day, seeing that, I just thought to myself, like, why does the world have to be like this? Now, I know most of you, and I don't think most of us have been in a war zone where we've had to sit there and watch that, but we've seen some things in our lives, right? We've done some things have been done to us, we've watched things, we've read things, and we know, we've asked this question many times before, right? Why does the world have to be like this? Why does it have to be violent? Why does it have to be so mean? Why does it have to be so arbitrary? Why does it have to hurt so much? Why is the world like this? And if you look around and if you study and if you read and you listen to the radio, you find answers. There's answers out there. I call them the long view of history answers. Like the people that are trying to answer that kind of question, like why, and give reason and look at all of history and explain where it's all going. And so some of the reasons that you've heard that might be familiar to you is the answer that says, well, this is just all there is. It's about struggle, it's about the strongest survive, and there is no real purpose to this. It's just meaningless struggle, so you might as well eat, drink, be merry, because tomorrow you die. There's another answer that says something like, well, it's just cycles. You repeat until you die, and then you come back, and you try it again, and you come back, and you try it again until you get it right and somehow transcend. There's a belief that's not really big in the United States and other places of the world that says this isn't really real, and so we just need to remind ourselves that this isn't really real, whatever it is. And then the one I grew up in is that it says that it's all going downhill. We can't help it. The world is just out of control. It's awful. It's evil. It's all going downhill. And someday I get to eject right out of this place. There is a whole series of popular books based upon this premise, okay? Some of you know of what I speak, right? But that's a big theme. If you listen to Christian radio and you listen to many, many churches in America, that's the narrative of many, many churches in America. I don't think that's the Christian message. I think that message is a piece of it, but leave some out. And so this morning what I want to do is I want to spend some time talking about the Christian long view of history. We're going to talk a little bit of Judaism. We're going to talk a little bit of Roman Pax Romana. We're going to talk a little bit about the Apostle Paul. And then we're eventually going to talk about resurrection. And we're going to do all of that in about 25 more minutes. All right? Good enough? So let's go. The first thing we have to understand is if we're going to look at a Christian-Jewish long view of history, we have to understand that in the Jewish mind, they saw themselves as actors in the story. Now, most of us, Jennifer and I love going to the theater. I don't know about you all. I love the theater, and I love musicals, all right? I listen to musicals in the car and sing along to Rent and Les Mis and Wicked. And I'm sure when Frozen is a musical, we won't be able to help ourselves from singing it, too. And so I like going to the theater. That's great. But in the theater, you go to sit and be entertained. You go to sit and watch, and the actors on the stage are doing something, right? And then there's the middle ground where Jennifer and I, last year when Jersey Boys was in town, we went to Jersey Boys, and we were sitting and we were trying to enjoy the show, and all the women around us all decided that they were going to be actors in the play as well. And so they were all singing every song with us. And I was so annoyed. And I did this. I can't believe I did this. In the middle of the show, I was sitting there and I finally did this number. And glared at the woman behind me. And then she toned it down a little bit because I wasn't paying to hear her sing the songs. I was paying for them to sing the songs. That's the middle ground. Most of us have never been, I've never been, to a place where we're actually actors in the story. Unless you've been in children's, preschool stuff where you all acted out. There's a theater in New York. It's in Chelsea. They bought a warehouse, and this group called Punch Drunk. They're a group from UK. They came over and did this. Anybody heard of this? It's called Sleep No More. It was on This American Life a year or two ago. And the idea is that when you go to Sleep No More, it's based on Shakespeare, this particular one. Punch Drunk does several different productions. But the one they did in Chelsea, when you get there, you're given a mask, and then you're allowed just to be in the play. Here's the description from one of the reviews I saw of it. According to the company, this version of Sleep No More boasts more than 100 rooms made up to look like English gardens, Scottish hotels, children's bedrooms, and witches' lairs. So this huge warehouse, 100 rooms. Spectators can follow 25 characters, Macbeth, Lady Macbeth, Mrs. Danvers, etc., as they seduce, traduce, and I don't even know what traduce means, and menace one another. Or an audience member can simply linger in Punch Drunk's ornate environments, skimming bookshelves, disturbing the shrubbery. So the idea is that when you go into this place, you go in, they hand you a mask, and then you just wander around. And it's happening, the play is happening around you, and you're part of the play. And if you open up the drawers, there's actually stuff in the drawers. Interestingly, the This American Life piece was more about how people act in such an environment where they're wearing masks and they're invited to participate, and people do crazy things. All right? But that's what it means to be an actor in the play. And to the Jews of Jesus' day, they believed that the answer to David Greed's question, why does the world have to be like this? The way they lived, the way they played their role in the story, they believe it mattered. They believe that part of the answer to his question was a result of some things that they had done, and the way out of it was some things they could do. They saw themselves as actors. They didn't see themselves as sitting back and watching it all spiral out of control so they could eject out. They saw themselves as a part of the story. Does that make sense? Very different than many of us see it. So here's the story that they believed in. They believed that originally there was the creation. And in the creation, everything is good. That God said that everything is good. When he created everything, he looked at it and said, it's good. And when he created human beings, he said, it's good. He didn't say, oops, like many of us think about ourselves. He said, it's good. And the Bible writers tell us that then he also then said that they reflect his image, that man and woman standing together before God, that they reflect God. They are the image of God. Imago Dei. Great name for a church. Although nobody ever has any idea. I had somebody just say, they're like, what's it called again? Spell it. And so the humans in the creation, that they reflected God in their desire to create, and their desire to make beauty, and their desire to organize, and their desire to take care of it, of the creation. In all of those ways, they reflected God somehow. And then the story goes on, and we've done a lot of paintings in history about this. We have the fall, and in the fall, we understand that the image is cracked. So the ways that they had harmony, where they once had harmony with God and they walked with God, the story tells us that now they hide from God, and they're aware of their nakedness, and they feel shame. Where they once had a beautiful relationship between them and no problems between them, the story tells us that now they have friction between the male and the female. Where they once lived in harmony with the garden, we find out that that's not going to be the case anymore, and it's going to be a struggle between the human and the... In every way, the image is cracked, the creation is cracked. Everything about it is cracked and distorted. And that's part of the answer to David Green, isn't it? One of the reasons that the creation is the way it is, one of the ways that things are the way they are, is because every single one of us here, we all contribute. Every one of us. We're all cracked icons. We're all cracked image bearers, bouncing into each other, hurting each other. I mean, just think about your own life. Yes, there's those things that happen outside that we have no control over. There's cancer and those kinds of things. But most of the really nasty wounds in life come from people that we love and trust, and it's their brokenness that rubs against us. And much of the damage we've inflicted on other people is how our brokenness gets worked out against them, right? Much of it is that. Much of the answer to his question lies here. In the Jewish story, they understand then, if you fast forward, then it goes on to tell us a little bit more about what it looks like. So when the fall happens, it's after that that we get the story of Noah. We find out that when a whole culture is full of broken image bearers, it gets really ugly really fast. We get Babel, we get the Noah's Ark story, we get Noah after the Ark story, all those things happen. And then in Genesis 12, we arrive at this place where God comes to Abraham and makes a covenant with Abraham and says, Abraham, here's the deal. I'm going to call a people, and I'm not going to call these people because I think they're better than everybody else. I'm going to call these people, and I'm going to use them as my agents in the world. They're going to be my agents for recreation. They're going to be my people through whom I'm going to make everything better. We're going to make the creation better. That Abraham, I'm going to bless you so that what? Oh, come on. I've said this before. I will bless you so that you can be a blessing. Abraham, I'm going to bless you so that you can go bless other people, that through you, the nations can be healed. The rest of the Hebrew scriptures are the story of how that doesn't work. There's a lot of crazy stories in the Hebrew scriptures. There's a lot of, like, when you read it, a lot of times when you read it and you go, I have no idea what this is about. This is just crazy town, right? But what it's trying to show us over and over again is how they couldn't do this. There's this great thing, if you're reading the book of Kings and Chronicles, where it's highlighting all the kings of Israel. And it says about each one of them at the end. Like, sometimes, once in a while, it'll say, this king was good. He followed in the path of his father, David. But most of the time, what it says is, this king, he was even more evil than the king before him. He was even more evil than his great-grandfather, Jeroboam. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. And that story gets played out over and over and over and over. And by the time, if you read the Hebrew scriptures, by the time it gets to exile, you're rooting for God. Like, let's just be done with it, okay? Like, they just can't do this. They never get this right. And so in 586 BC, they're wiped out. The temple that they built, the temple that they believed was the place where heaven and earth overlapped, was wiped out. They were taken out of the land. They lost some of the tribes, and they were put into exile. I think I just stomped on a couple of my slides here. They were exiled from the land. They were exiled from each other. 10 of the tribes disappear into Assyria, and we don't see them. They're scattered throughout the Assyrian Empire. They're exiled from the temple, this place. I just said that they believed that heaven and earth overlapped in the temple. In the Holy of Holies is where this physical world overlapped with heaven. And it was gone. The temple was absolutely destroyed. The project of being God's agents in the world was destroyed. This is the story that they thought they were in. They knew that they were in. They were exiled from their divinely appointed role as being God's agents. And then this psalm, I just want to read this to you, and I'll put it up on the screen in just a second. This psalm was very popular in Jesus' day because it has this sense of what exile looks like and their hope, because they believed even in exile that there was hope. This is the beginning of Psalm 2. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed. So they're talking about all these other countries are rising up against us. And they say, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. See, the idea is that even though they knew that they were in exile, the reason this psalm was so popular is that even though they knew they were in exile, there was hope that the exile wouldn't last forever. The exile goes on. By the time you get to Jesus' day, it's been a long time. The temple has been rebuilt. They've gone back to the land. They've rebuilt the temple. But the temple was never the same as it used to be. In fact, there was a long line of reasoning in Jesus' day that God had not returned to the temple, even though the temple had been rebuilt and then built by Zerubbabel and then rebuilt again by Herod, that God didn't reside in the temple. There's a story in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is some of the rabbinic writings, and there's a story, and you can take it for what it's worth. And the story is that when every year on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, which we talked about on Friday night here during our Good Friday service, there was a goat, and it was known as a scapegoat, and when the scapegoat, the sins of the people were laid on the scapegoat, and when the scapegoat was led in the wilderness and set free, to remind them that their sins had been taken out of the camp and they were released. And there was a legend that it was a red cord that was used to lead the goat out into the wilderness, and the red cord every year was hung in the temple. And that over the course of the next year, the cord in the temple would turn from red to white to remind the people that God had forgiven their sins. And the Mishnah tells us that when they rebuilt the temple, when they would hang the cord in the temple wouldn't change colors anymore because God wasn't in the temple. That even though they came back to the land, Jews in Jesus' day, the rabbis, the Pharisees, all those people, they would have had conversations that we're actors in this story. We've rebuilt the temple. We're back in the land, but God is not here. So there was a lot of fervor and a lot of energy. The word is zeal. They had a lot of zeal for, if we could just now be faithful to the law, if we can do the right things, then maybe we can get back on track and we can be God's called people. But we still find ourselves in exile. And there was a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of, we don't know. And there was a lot of hope that eventually somebody would come to lead the people back. And so in the time of Jesus, you can read about person after person who claims to be Messiah, who claims to be the person who's going to lead them to rise up and fight the Romans. The story of the Maccabees and the Hasmoneans and some of those stories we've told in here at other times are stories of people who, believing they are in exile, believe that they're the ones that are going to lead the people out of exile, that they're going to usher in a new age where God is going to come back and God is going to live in the temple again, and they're going to be God's people and they're going to bless everyone, and it's going to happen coming out of the temple in Jerusalem. And they saw themselves as part of that story. That was their story. And if they could just live up their end, God would be faithful to his side. That wasn't the only story in their day that was prevalent. The other story, obviously, if you know your first century history, is the story of Pax Romana. In 31 BC, on September 2nd, at the Battle of Actium, Caesar Augustus defeated Mark Antony. He wasn't Caesar Augustus yet. He was just, I think it was Octavian Augustus at that point. He defeated Mark Antony at the Battle of Actium. Then he marched back to Rome. And when he came back to Rome, what Augustus did is he entered the city, he was crowned emperor, and he went to this spot. This is the archway of Janus. There was a doorway that hung in there. And symbolically, whenever Rome was at war, that door would be left open. And it would be left open to signify that somewhere in the empire, we are at war. And what Augustus did when he came back to Rome after defeating Mark Antony is he went to that door and he shut the doors and he declared Pax Romana. Anybody know what that means? The peace of Rome. Yeah, that Rome is now at peace. The empire is now at peace. Now, historically speaking, we look back and go, yeah, right. You can declare it all you want, but, you know, like, there was still stuff going on. But the idea was that they believed in the reign of Augustus Caesar. They believed that this was the dawning of a new era, a new order, a new kingdom. Augustus's sponsor, Julius Caesar, had been deified after he died. After he died, they said, surely Caesar must have been a god. And so Augustus was referred to the son of a god. He reigned for something like 30 or 40 years. He died in about 14 or 15 AD. Before he died, in the last years of his reign, They weren't sure. It's pretty muddy when you read the history. And it depends on where you are in the empire. It's not real clear whether they were still sure whether he was still just a man or whether he had become a god. And you get the beginning of the emperor cult. After this, it kind of goes along for a while, and then eventually Caligula says, you know, you need to call me God. At least Augustus, when people called him a god, he was like, oh, I'm not really. But if you want to build a temple to me, I'm not going to stop you. All right? who does that? You know, if you want to all build a temple to me, it's fine with me, but you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with it. But go ahead. And so even in Jesus' day, you have these competing narratives between Pax Romana, the son of a god who's on the throne, who's bringing peace and a new world order and a new kingdom, and all the hopes of the empire behind that. And you had the Jewish hope that we are in exile, but God's kingdom is coming, and Caesar's kingdom is just a joke. After the death and resurrection of Jesus, we find the gospel writers, if you move forward into the New Testament scriptures, who are all Jews. They understand the story that they've been living in, and they understood the exile story, and they understood the creation and the fall and the calling and the exile. They understood all that, but what they saw in the resurrection of Jesus was the beginning of a new world order. And when you take your New Testament and you read it in the lens of what was being said about Rome at the time, we find that the New Testament writers are brilliant because they keep taking the language of the empire, the propaganda of Pax Romana, and they start applying all those things to Jesus, that he's the bringer of peace. He's the son of God. He's the one that's bringing a new kingdom. He's the one bringing a new world order. He's the one to be worshipped, not the emperor. And you get this competing narrative. And so Paul says things like this from Colossians. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. Kind of saying he's a big deal. That throughout this story, it's been about Jesus. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile himself to all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. A couple things. You notice here that what Paul's doing is he's co-opting the language of emperor worship. He's saying, no, understand that the one who is the first to resurrect from the dead, he's the one that's supreme in all things. He's the one that's redeeming everything and reconciling everything to himself, whether things on earth or in heaven. Either way, all of it's being reconciled to him. I set out this morning, and my attempt was to not quote my favorite theologian, and it was like one hand tied behind my back. So N.T. Wright, everyone. What creation needs is neither abandonment nor evolution, but rather redemption and renewal. And this is both promised and guaranteed by the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. This is what the whole world's waiting for. This is what David Green is waiting for. Not just abandonment, not just, hey, we're just out of here, let it go. Not just evolution, like it'll get better, but redemption and renewal. Why does it have to be like this? It has to be like this because this is what happens when cracked icons, cracked image bearers keep bouncing against each other. But the answer to how we fix it is in us. It's in the renewal and the redemption of all things. The things that Jesus talked about, the new kingdom that Jesus brought, the one of which he's the head, he's the firstborn of all of it, like that's the answer to it. Let me unpack it this way. Here's the Easter invitation. The invitation to all of us this morning is to become and to join and to participate. Sometimes when we get in churches, we talk about having right beliefs about God. Do you have to know a certain level of things? Like if you have to know this thing and this thing. And sometimes, like if you don't understand this particular doctrine or that particular thing, then we're not sure how Christian you are. But we're not asking you to believe a certain set of things. I'm not saying you have to believe a certain set of things. I used to be a lot more sure about a lot more things. And these days I find myself a lot less sure about a lot more things. I know, I don't know what I know, but I, whatever. What we're talking about, though, is becoming something and joining something and participating in something. We're all becoming something, right? We're either becoming more fit and healthy or becoming less so. We're all becoming older. We're becoming kinder or we're not. We're becoming something somewhere in your career. You're either becoming more successful, you're becoming better at your job, or you're going the other direction. Or you're, if you think you're, most of us can't just hold it, all right? Most of us don't just sit on, if you think you're just status quo, ask your spouse. They'll tell you what you're becoming. So this is an invitation to become something, to join something, to participate, to see yourself as an actor in the story, not just an audience member. The Easter invitation is to become or join or participate in Jesus' global reclamation project. A couple years ago, I was at a conference, and the speaker had two whiteboards. And on this side, he asked us, like, what are the biggest problems in the world? And so people started yelling out answers, like starvation, AIDS, war, like big problems, terrorism, you know, H1N1, whatever. It was a bunch of things that you hear in the news every day, right? Fresh water. Then he got over here and he said, what are we talking about in churches? Whether God elects people or they choose God, whether you can speak in tongues or not, what kind of Bibles we should read or not, whether you should have drums in church or not. And he says, why does this list have nothing to do with this list over here? My friends, here's the deal. I think many, many people have left the church because of the discrepancy between those two boards. Because while there's so many big problems in the world, in churches we find ourselves arguing about finer points of theology that I don't want to say they don't matter, because they do, but there's some big problems out there that we don't have anything to say about. And I believe that the Global Reclamation Project means that Christians should have, we should be talking about all these things. We should be talking about war and peace and poverty and AIDS and whatever else you think the biggest problems in our world are. If Jesus is reconciling everything to himself, how dare we leave off the biggest things in the world, the biggest problems in the world? Some of us have been taught at different times in our lives. We've been in churches where we talk about this. We talk about death and resurrection, all that. And it's just about our own souls and where our own souls are going when we die. And fine, that's a part of it. I understand that the reconciling has to happen in me, but it can't just be about me. It's about everything. Just like the Jews, we weren't just called so that we can go to heaven when we can die and wave to everybody as we eject out of here. We were called to be a blessing, to change everything, to become and participate in what Jesus is doing everywhere. The Easter invitation is to become, join, participate in Jesus' global reclamation project, to follow Jesus as the head, the first, the architect. I started to say earlier, I don't have everything figured out. I don't exactly know every finer point of theology. I've studied. I went to seminary. I have a master's degree. I have lots of books I can read, but I just find stuff really complicated and nuanced, and sometimes it's hard to know, but I know whom I follow. And that's all we're asking. That's all the invitation here is to know who we follow. What was Jesus about, and how do we follow? Last slide. The Easter invitation is to become, to join, to participate in Jesus' global reclamation project. To follow Jesus as the head, the first, the architect of a new world order, a new way of living and seeing. In Jesus' words, a new kingdom. I read somebody recently that said if you're following Jesus and it's not changing the way you see the world, how you see yourself and you see the world, you're probably not following Jesus. Because Jesus is continually leading us to see and to feel differently about the world than I just tend to by my own personality and upbringing. Some of us sitting here this morning, when we hear that, we've never heard that before. Some of us because, you know, we just didn't really grow up in the traditions, and that's fine. Some of us have sat in churches our whole lives and have never heard this. We've heard about how we should get our individual souls saved so that we can go to heaven when we die. But we've never heard the good news that what Jesus is wanting to do is put the whole creation back together. What Jesus wants is for Peoria to be put back. Jesus wants the violence in Peoria to stop. He wants the poor in Peoria to work and to eat. That's what Jesus wants. I think I can say that pretty confidently. I don't know a lot. I don't have all my doctrines. I don't know which theory of atonement's the right one. But I know that Jesus cares about poverty. And I know he cares about violence. And I know he cares about injustice. And I know he cares about equality. I know those things. And so some of you have never heard it talked about like that. You're sitting here this morning, and that's new information. And for some of you, you feel in you signs of life. Like, if that's what it's about, now that's interesting. If it's about getting the right doctrines and arguing about who's right and which church is better and which church worships better and we worship better than you do, we have a better doctrinal statement than you do, some of us are just sick of all of that. Count me to be the first one. I'm tired of all that. Because the global reclamation project of Jesus is bigger and there are bigger fish to fry than who has the right I's dotted and T's crossed. And so the invitation this Easter morning is to follow Jesus in this. Some of us this morning, we've heard this, and this is why we're here. This is exactly why we're here. And so for us, maybe Easter morning is a reaffirmation of what we believe. It's a reaffirmation that, yep, that is exactly what I want to be about. That's Jesus that I want to follow. Jesus that leads me into more religious stuff and responsibilities and sectarianism, forget that. But if that's what it's about, sign me up again for that. And so this morning what we're going to do with this is this. Here's how we're going to finish our service. Is I'm going to invite you to join, to participate, to become. And I don't want to do anything awkward. I don't want to make you raise your hand or stand up or anything like that, because I think this is something that's pretty it's pretty deep. This is not like what's the easiest way we can make it for people to sign a card and make sure that they go to heaven when they die. This is about reorienting one's life. This is about choosing to follow someone differently than me. And so what we're going to do is this. A couple weeks ago, we were on our way back from spring break, and we were driving. I'm pretty sure we were somewhere in southern Illinois, because I swear half the drive to Florida is in southern Illinois. It never ends. And Jennifer asked me to listen to a song that she really, really liked. And so she started playing it, and I rolled my eyes and said to her, "I don't listen to Christian radio." And so she played it, and I liked it. But I didn't want to give her the satisfaction of knowing that I liked it, so I just pretended I was sleeping. And she played it a couple times, and I thought, ka-ching, Easter service. And I think I told her 2 days ago, I'm like, oh, that song. We're kind of singing it. So what I want you to do is this, is I'm going to pray, and then we're going to start to play a song. And at whatever point in the song you want to join in, you might want to listen to the first verse or first chorus or two, but whenever you're ready, just stand up and join in the song as you're joining in. And if you're not in, I don't want to make you feel weird. Just stand up and don't sing, all right? I don't want you to feel like everybody's standing up now and I feel like the person in the room that everybody's looking at thinking, you heathen. Just stand up, okay? But you don't have to sing. It's like the Pledge of Allegiance. Just stand up. You don't have to say it, all right? For some of us, and I just offended a whole bunch of people. Sorry. sorry about that. I didn't mean to let that one out. So let me pray, and then we'll sing together. God, Jesus, I get worked up about this sometimes because I feel like so many things I've been told much of my life has been such a small picture of what you're trying to do in the world. Not that I don't love that you love me and that you care about my soul. I do. But nobody ever told me that it was so much bigger than that. It took me well into my adulthood before I understood that what you want to do has to do with all the biggest things in the world, that you want to reconcile everything to you. And so God, this morning, as we sing this song, we celebrate that. We celebrate that what you want to do is so big and it's so massive, and you're calling us, just like you called Abram, just like you called the Israelites, you're calling us into that story. You're calling us to get out of our seats and to get into the play and to be actors in the play and to do everything we can do to help reconcile as your people. God, as we sing the song this morning, we want to reaffirm, many of us, just to reaffirm to you that we are the people of God. We are the people that want to be your hands and your feet, and wherever we can reconcile the world to you, we want to do it. Thank you. Thank you for your death on the cross and for your resurrection and all the things we celebrate today. In your name I pray. Amen.